Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Greetings and welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Here's a taste of what you can hear in today's programme. Spotlight on the figure of Edith Stein, St. Teresa Benedicta of the Cross. And on the extensive work of the Vatican Information Office during the Second World War. Thanks very much for joining me. When Pope Benedict unveiled a statue on Wednesday, 11th of October, representing Edith Stein, or St. Teresa Benedicta of the Cross, placed in a niche of St. Peter's Basilica, no doubt his thoughts must have fleetingly gone back in time to that moving moment this past 28th of May, when, during his pastoral journey to Poland, he walked through what he referred to as a valley of darkness, the concentration and extermination camp of Auschwitz-Birkenau.
E qui sono morti, erano visti come
when under the pouring rain, holding a white umbrella, he'd walked past 22 stone tablets with inscriptions in different languages, which stand in the heart of the Holocaust Memorial. When speaking in Italian, he pronounced these words.
Tutte queste lapidi commemorative parlano di dolore umano.
All these inscriptions speak of human grief. They give us a glimpse of the cynicism of that regime, which treated men and women as material objects and failed to see them as persons embodying the image of God.
Nelle quali rifulge l'immagine di Dio.
And he added a moment later, the individual persons who ended up here in this abyss of terror were real people, people like
Edith Stein. Teresa Benedicta Cruce, Ebrea.
And now the statue of Edith Stein, canonized by the late John Paul II in October 1998, stands at the heart of Christendom, reminding us of her witness to the faith. I felt the time had come to try and find out more about this Carmelite. Turning to a fellow Carmelite who attended the unveiling, but also happens to be the editor of this academic's complete works, 25 volumes of them. He's General Secretary of the Carmelite Sisters, present in 90 countries across the world, German-born Father Ulrich Dobben. Pope Benedict unveils a statue of a saint called Edith Stein, Teresa Benedicta of the Cross. When she was canonized, the late Pope John Paul II said, "Now, alongside Teresa of Avila and Therese of Lisieux, another Teresa takes her place among the hosts of saints who do honour to the Carmelite order."
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes, but we have more Saint Teresas in our order. We have Saint Teresa of Los Andes, who is just present with a statue in Saint Peter. She is the first saint of Chile, Carmelite nun who died.
So the Pope was wrong.
Not really, because he said a third, but he didn't want to say
all
the Saint Teresas. Oh. We have some blessed Teresas also in the order.
Okay.
For instance, the Prioress of the Martyrs of Compiègne.
So, Father Ulrich, who was the Carmelite Saint Teresa Benedicta of the Cross, the first Jewish-born saint?
Mm-hmm.
What makes her so relevant to us in today's society?
Her personal history, her life, her personality,
What's so special about her personality?
Her personality is a very intelligent woman coming from a Jewish family, outstanding philosopher in Germany. She was an assistant of Edmund Husserl in these times maybe he was the most famous philosopher in Germany. She got the doctorate with him, summa cum laude, and her conversion to Catholicism was not so normal, because in this time many Jewish converted to Christianism, but to the Protestant confession. And she led or convinced by Teresa of Avila,
who lived
in the 16th century in Spain. Convinced by her, finally she decided to become a Catholic Christian in the Catholic Church.
The sequence of her conversion was strange. Jewish born, then she was atheist at one point.
She never uses the word atheist. She used the word unbeliever. And in the age of 14, it was in Hamburg, when she was in the house of her sister, she decided to give up all the prayers. It doesn't mean that she became an atheist, especially her niece living in California, the daughter of her youngest sister. She always insists, saying it is not a real atheism when a girl with 15 or 14 years old decides to give up the prayers. Another question is, in what an extent she had known the real Jewish religion? Because after, when she was a Catholic, she discovered the religious richness of Jewish religion. And I'm sure that after, as a Catholic, she was a better Jewish believer than before. The Catholic faith, the Christian faith, helped her to discover the richness of the Jewish religion.
She wasn't an atheist, as you said, but she was certainly a woman of doubt, a seeker,
yes,
no?
Yes, a seeker. It's a seeker. It's a very good word, a seeker.
Do you think that this doubt that she went through, this pain and this... When one doubts, so there's always a bit of pain, no?
Yes, moral pain.
Confirmed her so much as a staunch believer?
She was always seeking, and she was always seeking, because she didn't like to accept some things or some articles of faith when she hadn't studied them before as well as possible. It is interesting, before she converted to Catholic religion, she studied two very famous Catholic theologians, Johann Adam Möller and Matthias Scheben. In her times, these two professors were very famous with her dogmatic books. It means she wanted to understand the things well as possible with her intellect. And this means that she was doubting, but also seeking always.
When she made her eternal profession on the 21st of April, 1938, this erudite woman then, what you're saying, she was an erudite woman, she chose the words of another famous Carmelite, St. John of the Cross, to be printed on her devotional picture.
Yes.
But she wrote, "Henceforth my only vocation is love."
Yes.
So what is it? The intellect and love go together?
You must know that this text comes from the spiritual canticle of St. John of the Cross, the most outstanding poet in Spanish language. And she made a very good translation of this canticle later. I think that love and intellect are not an opposition, because a love without intellect is not good, and intellect without love is not even good.
So what you're saying, she's a very mature, complete person.
Yes, exactly. Two qualities complementing each other. One of the most important themes of John Paul II, in his last encyclical, I think it was his last encyclical, when he spoke also about Edith Stein in this context. Fides
et ratio,
exactly.
Faith and Reason, which is one of Pope Benedict the 16th's great
also
things.
He continues. Also, Deus Caritas is to have the thing.
God is love. One can't speak of Edith Stein without speaking of Auschwitz. I think that she is well known for her experience
exactly.
at Auschwitz and her witness.
I think it is one of the other points why she is such an important person, such an outstanding person of the last century, because she finished in Auschwitz. And she had accepted this kind of death willingly, even if she tried to escape until the last moment. She was always hoping, but she was at the same time very resigned to accept it as God had decided for her. I think she testimonies that God was present in Auschwitz, giving her strength. But I think it is a very difficult question. We cannot speak so easily about God, but Edith Stein was convinced until the last moment that God is with her.
Pope Benedict, when he went to Auschwitz in May this year, he spoke of Edith Stein and he said of her, he felt a deep urge to pause in a particular way before the inscription in German evoking her.
At Auschwitz-Birkenau, e qui sono morti,
and he said he gratefully hailed her and the others as witnesses to the truth and goodness, which even among our people were not eclipsed. We are grateful
ringraziamo queste persone
because they did not submit to the power of evil.
Perché non si sono sottomesse al potere del male.
And now they stand before us like lights shining in a dark night.
Ci stanno davanti come luci in una notte buia.
The reading of Edith Stein, a light shining in a dark night?
I think so, especially when we take in consideration her end, because her writings giving really a testimony about faith, and especially her last writing, Signs of the Cross, about St. John of the Cross, is finishing with the light of the resurrection. Edith Stein in her writing, Signs of the Cross, is giving a comment about all the writings of St. John of the Cross, putting her own experience. It is a mixture between a comment and testimony of life. It finishes with the light of the resurrection. We can suppose that in the last days before she was captured, she was writing this, because the writing is nearly finished, but it's only written by hand, it's a manuscript, and she was still working about it. And so we can suppose that in the last weeks before she was captured, she had developed these thoughts about the light of the resurrection following the prayer of the Angelus. The Angelus is the angel of the Lord, that we can come through his suffering and cross to the glory of resurrection.
Stein had to face the challenges of a radically changing century with its deep wounds and scars, a world of renunciation. No, she had to face that kind of world, whereas our Western world today is a world where everything is allowed. So what has she got to offer? What is the relevance of her witness to the new generations? There doesn't seem to be a lot in common.
I think that she was a person in search, a seeker. And I think under the relativism and under many other things we are living now, many persons are looking for values, are seeking for values, and so don't trust so easily the traditional values. But they are seeking. We should encourage the people to be seekers. Even if you are not always succeeding, maybe we are used to be succeeding, but faith is to be a seeker, in spite of all the insuccesses and all the problems you have, all the sins you are doing. It is important to remain in the way, to continue the way.
We mentioned two Carmelites earlier on in our talk, St. John of the Cross and St. Teresa of Avila, from whom she drew inspiration. Mm-hmm. Would you say that she has a particular Carmelite charism?
Yes, in a certain sense. She had entered very well in the traditional Carmelite charism, in the Theresian Carmelite charism.
Which what is it? What is the Theresian?
The prayer, interior prayer. It's a typical Theresian charism when it was not so common in the order. And St. John of the Cross, yeah, she had understood him also, but maybe St. John of the Cross insists more in love. He doesn't never use the expression a science of cross, but a science of love. We know that the real love accepts also the cross, but Edith Stein insists more in the cross. There are many crosses in her life, many crosses, not only Auschwitz, not only Auschwitz.
St. Teresa, then, of the cross, where does the Benedicta come in then?
Benedicta, blessed by the cross, yes. Her name became a reality in her life.
Our thanks there go to the General Secretary of the Carmelite Sisters, German-born Descalced Carmelite, Father Ulrich Dobbem. And now moving on in the broadcast, we focus on a book written by historian Margherita Marchionne, sister of the religious teachers of the Filippine, who provides a glimpse of the efforts on the part of the Vatican at the time of the War Pontificate of Pope Pius XII to provide comfort and assistance to millions of people. By the title of Crusade of Charity, in the book, Sister Marchionne explores the extensive work of the Vatican Information Office that responded to a staggering 20 million inquiries regarding prisoners of war and displaced people during World War II. The pleas for help in locating missing soldiers or civilians poured into the Vatican from people of all religions from across the world. My colleague Susie Hodges spoke to her and began by asking her what new information or perspective on Pius XII she was attempting to portray in her latest book, her sixth to focus on Pius XII.
Story of the grieved and heroic people in their own words, interspersed with letters, telegrams, and reports of the apostolic delegates around the world who, at the direction of Pius XII, visited in his name the prisoners in concentration camps, spread around the world. And it talks about what Pius XII did to help save Jews. And especially, it talks about the 20 million letters received from Jews and Christians throughout the world, young and old, who appealed to Pius XII for help in locating missing sons, husbands, relatives, or friends. And in his name, the Vatican Information Office dealt with these requests and provided information to comfort the people.
You say 20 million inquiries regarding prisoners of war. That's a huge number. What was it that inspired so many people to write to the Vatican then to locate their missing loved ones?
Well, people throughout the world try to get information from their own governments and from the International Red Cross and could not succeed. Many of the letters that I have included in my new book tell that story. And so their last hope was in Pope Pius XII. And as word spread from one family to the other, they all just centered their attention on seeking help from the Pope. And you know, the interesting thing that these 20 million letters are from people of all nationalities and all religions from every part of the world. I selected only 100, and I selected them from a book that was published a few years ago. I did not go through 20 million, of course. And these letters, I went to the Vatican Secret Archives in order to locate information about these 100 letters. And I did find file cards that include information about the letter that was received by the Vatican Information Office and the copies of the responses that were sent to these families and all other pertinent information relating to them. These documents really express the faith and the confidence of families with regard to their loved ones who were prisoners of war or who were missing in action. And they really tell the role of Pius XII toward all victims of the Nazi terror and give proof of the historic truth.
Among these 100 letters that you selected for inclusion in your book from the people that wrote to the Vatican, are there one or two that really stand out in your memory as being especially poignant?
Oh, there are so many, dear. Each one of the letters was a meditation as I read them, and you cannot help but be moved by them. There are letters from little children begging the Holy Father to locate some member of their family. And one little boy says, you know, I have to make my first Holy Communion. I want my daddy to be here with me. One soldier begged His Holiness to contact him from the prison where he was, to contact the family. The soldier said, for the past several years, we have been away from our country, from our family, from our home. We recall the smile of a mother, the embrace of a father, the kiss of a brother. Some of us long to see a son whom we have not yet seen. Men subjected to all the elements of bad weather dream of an oasis, a little green, a little rest in the midst of so much battle, so much blood, so much chaos, so much death. A funereal shadow envelops humanity, and we are fighting without hope in the midst of so much ruin and devastation. Now, how can you read that and not cry?
Your book, of course, also reprints some of the Vatican's replies to these pleas for help. How illuminating are these? Again, have you got one or two outstanding examples that you can give?
Actually, many. There are many examples that these letters have received answers. Let's say someone was asking for a particular soldier in the letter who was claimed missing. Well, the file card will reveal that that person was indeed alive. And can you imagine the joy of a family receiving that kind of information? What I did with each letter, I followed the request with a report of what I found on the file cards. So some of them, for instance, actually I have the answer of this prisoner, Alessandro, who sends a letter to his mother. He says, I am in Addis Ababa, enjoying good health, and send you affectionate greetings. You know, so they were able to communicate. And remember, the Vatican had the advantage of the Vatican radio, because what they did was announce the name of the missing person, and then the apostolic delegates would go and locate that person once they were able to communicate. So I think that the Vatican radio deserves a great deal of credit for having mitigated the sorrow of these families by giving information about the missing and the prisoners of war.
Yes, I gather it in fact broadcast over 1.2 million shortwave queries. That's no small number, is it, in the space of about 5 years?
Not. And you know, it was very costly too for the Vatican. The Vatican used all its funds to help people during the Holocaust.
How successful was the Vatican in, as you say, sometimes managing to trace these people or find out that they were alive? Can you put any kind of percentage on those stories that had a happy ending, as it were?
Yes, I would say of the 100 letters that I have in my book, I would say 90% received information, and favorable information, too, that the Vatican did succeed. I would like to say this, too, that the letters that I selected were all directly sent, addressed to Pope Pius XII. Many others were addressed to the Secretary of State and to other people in the Vatican, but I selected only those directed to His Holiness.
You said that many of those letters came from non-Catholics. Roughly what percentage was that?
Well, I would say at least 10%.
And were many of those letters indeed from Jews?
Yes, they actually state that they were Jews. They begin that way. They alert His Holiness. This is a letter from Milan Franek, the uncle of 38-year-old Fonson, a Catholic whose wife is Jewish. They reside in Croatia, and he says, "I have only learned that because she is Jewish, she was arrested. Now, the Vatican search for this man, whose Jewish wife was sent to a concentration camp, began March 24, 1942. The response was an autographed letter written in Serbian, dated June 6, 1942. And it gives the answer.
And what was the answer, very briefly?
That he was saved, that he was alive. There were 800 volunteers in this office. Can you imagine?
I presume that when it comes to the staff, it had to increase enormously to cope with this workload.
Oh, absolutely.
Many thanks there to Sister Margherita Marchione of the Religious Teachers of the Filipine, speaking there to Susie Hodges. And that brings us up to time. Thanks for listening. I'm Veronica Scaresbury. Be sure to check out our website. The address is www.vaticanradio.org/English. Bye for now, and don't forget that we'll be back again at the same time tomorrow.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.